Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform with Justin Asiri, where I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today's episode number 33 with Britt Young.
Just being totally honest, and this might offend some folks, but you really are behind, you know. And it's a better assumption that you're behind than that you're ahead. Look, it's not like everyone else who wasn't spending any time in the military is out there playing Lincoln Logs, right? Like, they've got a job and they're like developing skills and they're learning, right? So I went into my transition with the attitude that I was 9 years behind every pedigreed person out there. And I feel that attitude helped drive my hunger to play a very intense game of catch up.
Britt works at Palantir Technologies, a Bay Area technology startup that has raised over $2 billion in funding. He is the chief of staff to their chief technology officer. Top four reasons to listen to today's interview. First, motivation. Britt provides a very balanced, sobering perspective on how we are behind when we transition from the military. Our civilian counterparts have been working just as dedicatedly as we did in the military, and so Britt talks about adopting a mindset about how to best catch up. Second, perspective. Britt shares about how the death of a friend in the military early on during his job search refined his thinking about what he wanted out of a career and how that guided him in his job search. Third, tenacity. Britt talks about how, after his transition from the military, he set the goal of one conversation a day as a means of building his mental picture of the landscape of career options and collecting more data about what job would be right for him. This includes how he saw interviews as a way to gain more data about the types of people he'd want to work with and the office environment in which he'd like to work. Fourth, leadership. He's got some very compelling thoughts on how the software industry is more tolerant of bugs, mistakes, and failures, and how this changes the leadership style many of us learned in the military. So here is, without further ado, my conversation with Britt Young. Well, my guest today is Britt Young. He is quite the traveler, but I think I'm catching him when you're in Palo Alto. Is that right, Britt?
Yep. Currently stateside.
Awesome. Well, for listeners, quick background on Britt. He is the chief of staff to the CTO at Palantir Technologies, which is a Palo Alto-based technology company that's raised over $2 billion in funding and was co-founded by Silicon Valley legend Peter Thiel. Britt started out at the Naval Academy, and he served as an officer in the Navy for 5 years, where he served in Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom, supporting special operations forces in kinetic and non-kinetic operations. Britt transitioned from the military directly to Palantir Technologies, first as a deployment strategist, then as their head of Asia ex-Japan, where he leads Palantir's Asia headquarters, a team of 15 people, and now is the chief of staff to the chief technology officer. Britt, I guess maybe to start off, when did you know you were going to leave the Navy, and how did you approach that decision?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Full disclosure, I wouldn't recommend the path that I took. I was downrange and probably wasn't having the most positive experience. And in retrospect, I look back at my career pretty fondly, and it's definitely an important developmental milestone for me. But at the time, I was on my second trip downrange. And I didn't feel like I was having a, very little positive impact at the tactical level. I'm sure people feel differently about, their impact on the war on terror, as it was called at the time. But, I thought that things kind of in Iraq and Afghanistan and our general strategy, in combating, radical Islam or whatever you want to call it, I just didn't feel like it was trending in the right direction. And I didn't feel like I was making, really strong headway. I guess hindsight's 2020, but certainly, things have not turned out pretty well in this part of the world. And so, I think in my situation, there was a little bit of angst when you have kind of material disagreements around the strategic direction of your organization. Mm. And then, from a career perspective, I think at some point you have to look at your boss's job and your boss's boss's job and ask if that's where you want to be. And for me, the answer was pretty clear. So that's sort of how I came to the decision and decided that there was other stuff in life that I could make positive impact in.
And I'm assuming then you chose not to do the reserves and just did a clean break when you got out.
So I did sell res for a bit. I didn't think too much about it, to be honest. I ended up going IRR once I got settled into civilian life. At the time the Navy was pushing folks to go IRR, so this was a pretty trivial process, surprisingly. But I wouldn't say I have, it was not a well thought out thing, to be sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And as you look back on that transition to civilian life, what were some of the more surprising aspects that you didn't know to expect about that transition?
I got back to the States in February, and I spent 2 to 3 weeks cramming for the GMAT and GRE to throw together an application to go to some B schools. And I knew my odds were pretty slim because I was applying round three to some competitive places. And this is, you know, this is not the optimal approach to get into B school, to say the least. And so I think I learned that. That was a bit of a surprise when I was kind of doing the research. Like, oh, wow, you know, you've got like a infinitesimal chance of actually being accepted in any of these places. So enjoy that. So I knew I would have to string along my last few paychecks for a while. So as I was tying up my separation paperwork, I moved, I literally moved on my buddy's couch. Like, I threw my stuff into storage and lived on his couch with like a comforter and a pillow for what ended up being like 4 months until I got a job.
That's a powerful motivator to find a job too, by the way, I'm imagining, right?
Oh, yeah. Big time. And so unsurprisingly, the B schools came back and said, hey, thanks, but no thanks. And I, you know, I'd been concurrently looking at jobs at the same time, but the rejection letters definitely put the job search into high gear, you know, that in conjunction with the couch living. So, and I was looking at, you know, I was looking at pretty typical stuff, you know, the JMO recruiters, you know, consulting. You know, I went to the SACC job fair, and it was all pretty whatever for me. And then April 26th rolls around, and one of my friends, who was still downrange, he got blown up. And up until that point, I thought I would never think about the military again. You know, I thought the military-industrial complex was kind of in the rearview mirror, and I was going to go and do whatever. You know, not to get all metaphysical, but, you know, it was very apparent at that point that, you know, you only get one life and that's it. You know, you just get one. So, you know, why am I talking to folks about being a factory manager or a PowerPoint monkey? Like, what, you know, this is it. You only get one shot at this thing. So the positive framing, I think, is that I was forced to make some pretty big life decisions and confront some existential stuff. And, and sometimes I get the impression that transitioning vets kind of kick that existential cannon down the road a little bit. And over-optimize on the tactical kind of decision-making. So, yeah, maybe that would be – that's kind of a background on all the surprises that I had.
Yeah, man, that's crazy. I mean, I'm thinking in my own life, I've had two close friends that passed away, and each time the effect was it kind of turned down the volume on a lot of the noise in my life. And my experience was similar in terms of just a lot more clarity in terms of, like, man, what am I doing? What are my priorities? What matters? And you start to realize how much just stupid stuff you end up doing or things that you're not really enjoying. And so it's a sad perspective, but I think it's like so powerful, like the way you said it too, of like, you know, what am I doing? Am I doing something I'm passionate about? And like really getting that clarity at a time when you could really benefit from career clarity.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So how did you approach that job search then? It sounds like you were using, you talked about the SACC fair, job fair, you talked about kind of some, the JMO, was that like rotational programs or recruiters? I'm just wondering like how you ended up in technology or even knew that you'd want to do that.
No, it's a great question. And it's certainly a non-obvious transition for a lot of vets. And you know, my goal was, you know, to have a deep conversation with someone in the civilian sector every day. That was my goal while I was living on the couch. It could be a random dude doing whatever. It didn't matter. You know, what I wanted was to hear, you know, what got that person up in the morning, what their values were, what they were motivated by, what they enjoyed, what they didn't enjoy, asking kind of these really and going very deep with one person every day. That was my marker of progress during that transition. And, you know, and the reason was is because I had no concept of what people did. I had no concept of what job functions entailed. I had no understanding or empathy for something simple like what is sales or what is marketing.
Yeah,
you know, it was very humbling.
How did you do that? How did you get a hold of those people to speak with? Like, what was that process like?
Oh, I mean, it was like when I say it could have been any random dude. I mean, I talked to anyone that would possibly you know, listen, it was like, we're talking to the manager of a diner. I mean, it didn't matter. I was self-aware of my own ignorance and knew that I just needed to collect data.
Yeah.
And needed to talk, have these conversations. And if there's one thing I did right, it was asking these hard questions to develop a sense of taste around what I thought would be interesting. And fortunately, you know, I never really compromised on my taste of what, you know, interesting would be. But, you know, I'd be lying if I say I didn't, you know, if I said I didn't come close to caving and working for some, you know, defense contractor or something. There was definitely moments when I was like, well, I can take this job.
Yeah.
So once I learned about Silicon Valley and what the ethos of, you know, what this place is all about, I knew I would end up working at a tech company. And I didn't know how that would take hold, but I knew the mindset was just really appealing to me.
What would you, especially for someone listening who's on active duty, how would, and I know there's a lot more popular media focus on Silicon Valley now, but how would you explain that to them? Like, what was it that attracted to you, or how would you explain what that environment is like, why it was appealing?
Sure, yeah. I mean, so to be fair, you know, I would not have used the word Silicon Valley when I was transitioning in 2012. I didn't know what that was, but I did know that when I interviewed at Palantir, you know, one, no one was wearing a suit. They were all wearing like not suits, and so that's it's a superficial signal, but it's enough to catch you by surprise.
Yep.
And the interviews were just unbelievably substantive. I mean, it was like, you know, really deep stuff. You have a lot of interviews, and I feel like, at least my sense was that they are very high level. You may not get too deep with the behavioral questions. And the interviews I had were just incredibly deep. And then when they talked about
was that deep in terms of like asking you what the meaning of life is, or deep in terms of like really difficult challenges they were asking you to solve, or how was it not superficial?
It was, they asked why. Right. That was the it wasn't just a what question.
Yeah.
It was a, you know, why would you do this?
Yeah.
And you ask, you know, why a bunch of times, you're going to end up having a pretty, you know, substantive conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Honest. And then when these folks were talking about the company, they weren't just talking about building a piece of software. You know, they were talking about this vision they had about inspiring people and enabling people to make data driven decisions and thinking about data, you know, as a medium for folks to have an honest conversation. And that, you know, really resonated with me, this idea of having a data-driven decision-making. And then to choosing our clients in a way that, you know, we were going to get to really change the world because we were going to work with these great institutions. And people were excited about that. I mean, they were excited. And that was the thing, is I'm having this interview day and people were stoked about what they're doing. You know, that in and of itself was pretty awesome. So there's a lot of different kind of aspects that were radically different than other places that I was talking to.
It's interesting because thinking back to your experience in the military, and just it sounds like one reason why you eventually left the military was you didn't feel like you were having a direct impact in the way that you wanted to on the world. And it sounds like one of the things that was the primary motivators to join Palantir was seeing an organization that you believed in that was having a big impact on the world. It's just interesting, that parallel.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that strategic, you know, having that strategic vision and being aligned with the larger vision, you know, makes the day-to-day, you know, because the day-to-day can always be rough. But it definitely brings a lot of meaning to that. For sure.
So once you started, you know, you identified that you wanted to be in tech or Silicon Valley or however you would have defined it. How did you find Palantir in particular?
Sure. Yeah. So I had used Palantir downrange, so I was familiar with the product. And I would say, you know, that's a huge advantage when you're thinking about applying somewhere. It helps to have used a product and to like it. When you use a product, you just have a much easier time conveying your enthusiasm and articulating how you can deliver value, because you can always kind of map that back to, you know, the product itself. So, you know, and to be frank, I probably knew more about the product, how the product was used in the field than some of the people that were interviewing me at the time.
That's awesome.
Which was kind of cool, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, to be, you know, the counter side of that is, to counter that a little bit, is to say, it would be to say that, you know, just because you've used, you know, Facebook doesn't mean you'd be a great Facebook employee,
right? Yeah.
From the candidate perspective, you know, application processes are about kind of convincing companies that you can make a valuable contribution, and you know, kind of quelling some of the risks they have or concerns they have about you. You know, every company does that differently. So, you know, I'm not sure, you know, going into Palantir's hiring process is useful, but I think the larger point is around, like, you have to be able to articulate your value proposition and address kind of the risks that a company's going to have. Those are kind of the big points when thinking about, like, the application process anywhere.
What about how many, you know, and I know this was a while ago, but just broadly speaking, how many companies in tech did you reach out to and interview? I'm always curious to learn about the funnel of, you know, what led to the job that you wanted.
That's a great question. How many in tech did I reach out to? I mean, it's been a little while. I don't know if I said the first conversation with a guy in tech I had was actually, this is actually kind of a funny story. I was leaving the Service Academy Career Conference at like, you know, 4 p.m. So, like, you know, everyone's gone, right? Everyone's, and the guys at Apple, there were some folks, the recruiters were there. And I was like, oh, well, I have an iPhone. I'll go chat with these guys, because I've already chatted with everyone I thought it would be useful to. So I go over to the table, and this guy's name was Frank. And I was like, hey, you know, how you doing? And I had no idea what I was doing, right? I mean, just no idea how any of this stuff worked. And I was like, so how's it going for you? Like, was this a positive experience for you today? Like, what do you think of it? I have never seen so many super qualified people that have absolutely no idea what they want to do with their life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it struck me on two levels. One, like, the statement itself is incredibly true, right? And then, but on another level, kind of the meta level, is that this dude was like the only guy to say anything substantive or honest the entire day, right? Like, yeah. There's all these companies that are, you know, it's just completely overloaded buzzword speak. And this dude, Frank from Apple, was like the guy that was like going to have, you know, had known me for all 15 seconds and was willing to make an honest statement.
Yeah.
So that was one of those kind of like small data points, right? That kind of sticks with you, like, wow, I just had this really great conversation with this guy that, you know, I've never met before. So how many, I think your original question was like how many I applied to. I don't know. Probably, I mean, how many did I go to the website and submit my, you know, crappy resume? I mean, God knows how many, probably quite a few. I actually interviewed for Palantir the same week that I was looking at some like defense contractor stuff in DC. And so they were the first choice because I knew the product. I thought I knew the company because I said, okay, well, I know their deal, right? I understand what they do. And it was a little harder to wrap my head around, you know, what I would do at Intel or what I would do at, you know, even Google or Apple. I just didn't know, like, you know, how am I going to add value there?
And did you drop your application on the Palantir website?
So this is a testament to how, like, random people. Like, I had coffee with this guy who was at this like think tank for like US India relations or something. I mean, talk about, and I don't even know how I was connected to the guy. Looking back, I can't even remember how we got connected. So I'm at one of these coffees doing what I was doing at the time, which is asking people about their lives and, you know, their jobs and whether they like their jobs or not. And so we were talking, and he's like, have you heard of Palantir? And I was like, yeah, I've used the product. It's good stuff. And he was the first person that was like, oh, you don't understand. Like, that company, it's like, it's not like any other company in the defense space. Like, trust me. And so he like sent my resume to another guy who looked at it and was like, okay, you know, you want to apply. And so that's, you know, you kind of, I'm not sure there's a generalized lesson there other than, you know, you can kind of create your own serendipity if you're just kind of like persistent enough, I guess.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's why I asked, because I just so rarely meet people who got their job by just applying online. It's almost always that sort of story of like knowing someone or running into someone. And that's, you know, that like you said, that's so random. You can't engineer that to happen. But I think it speaks more to if you are just approaching this as a full-time job and you are just getting out there. And like you had said, you started by getting more data points. You started by talking to everyone about what they did. And that's just, you know, you have enough of those conversations, eventually it's going to snowball into something.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
I also liked what you were saying about the interview process of how even these little interactions were many data points, and seeing what they wore in the office or how they talked to each other or what the interview process was like. It's just all of those things are informing you, is this the right fit for me or would I be happy here? And I know that's different for every person, but I think it's interesting that even the interview process can be used as a filter of, is this the type of place I want to work?
Oh, absolutely. I had some really negative interviewing experiences, where it was clear that the values, there just wasn't value alignment.
Yeah.
And especially in case, I think more so in maybe case study interviews, you can kind of get that because it ends up being more of a discussion, right? You kind of are asking for more information and it becomes kind of a discussion. And as you know, you're having that discussion, it becomes apparent. They kind of show their hand a little bit, right, about what they're about, what they're looking for. And Palantir is a software company. We're run by, you know, it's an engineering, very engineering driven organization. So it's very apparent that, like, the things we want to do, you know, things is build stuff. We want to build stuff that makes the world better, you know, that has a positive impact on the world. That's our jam, you know, and it's very apparent, you know, when you walk into our office and you have a conversation with somebody, they're thinking of, you know, they're building stuff. That's what we do, you know, and we're not a sales organization, you know, and there's nothing wrong with a sales organization. It's fine, if you're in one, but it's very apparent in these conversations, the ethos, the underlying ethos that informs kind of these small comments or small signals that you can kind of pick up on.
Another thing I was curious about was, especially in the first couple years out of the Navy, in what ways did you feel ahead of your civilian counterparts because of your military experience? And in what ways did you feel like you had to really work to catch up to them?
Yeah, that's a great question. And just being totally honest, and this might offend some folks, but, you know, you really are behind, you know, and it's a better assumption that you're behind than that you're ahead.
Yep.
Or even on par with someone your age who didn't take the military detour in the game of life. and look, it's not like everyone else who wasn't spending any time in the military is out there playing Lincoln Logs, right? Like they've got a job and they're like developing skills and they're learning, right? So I went into my transition with the attitude that I was 9 years behind every pedigreed person out there. You know, I feel that attitude helped drive my hunger to play a very intense game of catch up. And I don't, you know, mean to kind of perpetuate a rat race view of life, but it's more that, you know, I believe that I had every bit of potential as anybody else. But I needed to educate myself in a lot of ways so I could make the highest possible impact. I guess the positive framing would be that there were some areas where I was ahead. I think the most obvious one, which a lot of vets will kind of relate to, is you know, being comfortable in extremist situations. It wouldn't be true that. It wouldn't necessarily be true that my worst day at Palantir was better than my best day in the military, but it's like directionally correct, right? Like a bad day in civilian life just isn't all that bad, right? You know, I mean, at least in mine, maybe, you know, I'm certainly very fortunate. So not once have I ever kind of been commuting to my job and wondered like, well, I wonder if like someone put a bomb in the side. My job, like, no, that's never ever once like entered my head as a civilian, which is nice. I sort of like that, and you know, another area I think is having kind of this a level of intensity, And there was always just, there's always just been another level that I could hit. And I feel like there's, you know, a sense of kind of ruthless prioritization in some parts of the military. And I definitely took that with me as well. So those would be kind of two areas, I think, where I probably did have a slight advantage. But that's, you know, it's hard to articulate sometimes.
You know, but I love it. It's hard to imagine much downside if someone adopts that mindset of, I am 5 years or 7 years or 9 years behind my civilian counterpart, and therefore I have to work smarter and harder to catch up. As opposed to, you know, sometimes when I meet with people, or there's aspects of myself where you feel cocky and you feel like, oh, everyone, you know, everyone has been playing Lincoln Logs. Everyone's been goofing off for this time that I was serving. And it's like, no, these, you know, if you want to run in the circle of people who are very hungry and very hardworking, those people were working just as hard as you in the civilian world. So I like adopting that mindset, because then it does push you further to try to learn and try to think faster and try and work harder to be in that same playing field.
For sure. For sure.
I'm just curious about, for someone on active duty listening, what does your day-to-day life look like? Just painting that picture of kind of what life looks like within a really well-established high-tech company.
Sure. You know, it's definitely changed as my roles in the company have changed. And super fortunate to work at a place where, you know, lateral movements are almost trivial. So that's been a really great perk. It's being able to say, hey, look, I want to work on the commercial side of our business now, or hey, I want to work on the product side of our business now, and getting a shot to do that because you built up credibility. But just to kind of give you a sampling, you know, when I first got to the company, I spent a lot of time implementing our software at a client, which was ended up being kind of a mix of like project manager, product manager, relationship manager, and kind of master of chaos. You know, it was a total trip. It was just like drinking from the fire hose, to use the analogy. You know, there was days when I was sitting with users, understanding their pain points, understanding, you know, the way they were doing things currently, trying to map that to how you do that with the platform. You know, there's days when you're interfacing with senior leaders at the client to give them an update on what's going on and scoping the next piece of work and talking about, you know, what the financial kind of implications of that are. So it's definitely all across the map. But at the end of the day, it's essentially, you know, we want people to use our software to do good stuff. Mm-hmm. Right. And we sort of have an attitude of, you know, we got to do what it takes to get there. And so if that means you got to play out of position a little bit, you know, then guess what? You got to take the meeting and be the guy. So, you know, it was very clear that our goals, you know, were to have those positive outcomes through our software platform. And so that, you know, that meant that, yeah, I mean, it's getting on flights. It's talking to product teams. It's doing what it takes to make that happen. Mm.
How much do you end up traveling? I'm just curious, like in a year or in a month, or I'm just wondering how often you're on the go.
Yeah. You know, so I always do travel. I don't want to say a perk. I wouldn't want my boss to hear that. but you know, I thought it was cool. Like I thought, hey, you know, I get to go to places that I never would get to go to before, and talk to people who are different and have different, you know, have different mission sets and have different goals. And that's just, to me, is one of the things that makes life interesting. Yeah. You know, so. It's, you know, at this company, you can travel as much as you want to. You can, you know, and I also know folks that have, you know, have those boundaries and aren't as, don't see travel the way I do and they don't travel as much. But there's, I would say for folks that do enjoy that and enjoy the getting on plane and making it happen, you know, there's as much of that as you want there to be. Mm.
And I like too, I mean, my experience with consulting was it's a very different form of travel. I mean, you have your phone with you, you have internet, you're in a hotel, you're eating food. It's not, you know, I associated travel in the military as pretty Spartan.
Yeah.
And it's not that. It's a little, it's not like it's vacation, but it's certainly not isolation either.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'd forgotten about that. I forgot when I first started traveling with the company, I was like, man, this is the best. Why would you travel all the time? you can eat at restaurants at night, and it's so cool. And you know, to be fair too, like a lot of the travel I was doing and continue to do, they're great locations. It wasn't like I was going to, you know, Flint, Michigan, but somewhere that wasn't fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm going to New York. I'm going to London. I was in Hong Kong not too long ago. You know, like the places I get to go to are in my opinion, fun places to be. So I think it's all relative. And like I said, for me, it's a perk and I've enjoyed it. But that doesn't mean that has to be your life. I think there's a lot of roles that it doesn't make sense to travel. So it's something to think about when you're looking at your transition is, do you want travel to be a part of your life, or is that, for whatever reason, not really a viable thing for you?
Mm. And, you've been in a lot of leadership roles and interacted with a lot of leaders within the world of tech. In what ways have you seen that leadership in Silicon Valley or in technology or just in civilian world in general, how does that differ from leadership within the military?
It depends on which kind of or what kind of organizations you're in. But in an organization where the value proposition is your creative intellectual property, you're going to have a different way of managing people. The other end of the spectrum is that you're working at a company where it's 100% operational expertise where you're managing some sort of machine and the efficiency of that machine is kind of all that matters. And there's no real kind of, you can make kind of marginal 1-2% improvements, but there's not really huge upside. So in the creative side of things, you can make these 10x improvements. It's huge upside. But it's also frustratingly non-deterministic. So there's a different, I think that's sort of where people get this impression that it's all like some sort of bohemian, commune out here. because, software, we're very fortunate that we deal in a domain that's, completely ephemeral. I don't have to worry about, physics. I don't have to worry about, the constraints of materials, right? Software is completely ephemeral. So that all kind of feeds into the management style, which tends to be a lot of the values that we had in the service around leadership style, at least, have to do with that operational excellence. You're operating at the end of the day. I think you were a submariner, you're operating power plant in a big tube underwater. And it's like this super complex, system, right? Like super complex. And you've got to be really good at that. Cause if you're not good at that, you're all going to die. It's a really big deal. But it's in software, it's if you mess up and you have a bug, guess what? Every piece of software ever has bugs and you can fix it really quickly. Mm-hmm. So the management style tends to be a little more accepting of risk and accepting of chaos and accepting of volatility and accepting of weirdness. Because the downside just isn't that severe. Now there certainly are certain types of software, firmware in cars and avionics software that wouldn't be true. But to the most large extent, the software that's being built in Silicon Valley right now happens to be, much more have much less in the ways of severe consequences if it's buggy.
I never put together the ties between the military and physical products. And you're right. I'm just thinking of if you ship a physical product or a car or something like that with a major defect, there are major ramifications. Just like in the military, there's even more dire consequences for a mistake. But with software, there's just not that same sense of that a bug or a problem or a defect is the end of the world. And, even Apple, I'm just thinking of every software update that they put out. There's always something wrong or some sort of glitch. And that's one of the best companies in the world. And so while it's not desirable, it's to be expected as well.
Yeah. No, for sure. I think that's absolutely right. It's a different mentality. And if you think about it just from kind of a financial perspective, if you're a software company, really the only thing you've got on your balance sheet is real estate, which is a proxy for the number of people you have, right?
Yep.
It's not like you have this cash flow generating asset, right? You don't have a power plant or a plane or any of that kind of stuff. The thing that's giving you the asset that you have is this is a human being. So that changes the management style too. We're like, it actually means that the most valuable thing in the balance sheet is, you know, it's going to be, you know, the biggest costs at least are going to be real estate and payroll, right? So, you know, as a consequence, the leadership, you know, usually cares very deeply about people, because that's where you're investing all this money to generate the product, because we aren't constrained by other material needs. So it's a different, it ends up producing a very different leadership mentality.
And if someone's listening and they're thinking of exiting the military, is there any advice you'd give them on how to prepare for that transition, resources to consider, or how they can make that transition a little bit easier?
So I'd say, like, exactly, like, precisely 100% of all the vets I've talked to about the transition say that it sucked, right? So it's going to suck, you know, it's going to feel weird, and it's disorienting, and it's scary, and it's, you know, it's supposed to kind of feel that way. The military is kind of insular in a lot of ways. And so you're kind of entering, when you leave the military, you're kind of entering this alien culture called reality. and you know, like I said, I was looking at the first version of my resume the other day, and it was just like it was just a complete disaster. And it was an absolute dumpster fire. And so, you know, you should kind of expect to suck, and as a consequence of that, you can kind of factor that into your game plan by, you know, kind of maybe taking the low consequence engagements first and getting your reps in, because that's kind of the only way you're going to get better. You know, fortunately, you end up growing fast and it ends up working out, but, you know, make sure you kind of ease into it and give yourself some compassion in the process.
I love that. I'm just thinking of, in the fundraising process for startups, I just found that you always meet with the least desirable investor for the first couple times, because you're just going to make so many mistakes. And like you said, get the reps in, figure out what you're doing before you go meet with your ideal job or investor, because you got to get the kinks worked out first.
Yeah, and it really does help to understand your risk profile. And people kind of, I don't think a lot of folks kind of think about this, but it's, you know, a very crude example or a crude thought experiment would be that, you know, that a 1% chance of making $1 billion is kind of statistically equivalent to a 10% chance of making 100 million or 100% chance of making 10 million. So, you know, even though they're kind of equivalent on paper, you know, kind of area under the curve, they're actually totally different from a human perspective, right? You're going to fall somewhere on that curve, and you're probably going to feel very strongly about where you fall on the curve. And that's going to, both the risk and the growth expectations of a company are going to have very far-ranging effects on the mentality of the people there. And there's this common kind of failure mode for vets sometimes in the transition discussion to go like super tactical, to talk, you know, the specifics on, like, you know, how to interview and how to tighten up your narrative and how to dress and how to talk and how to, you know, write your resume. And those, you know, those are all really important things, but they're necessary yet insufficient. And a lot of unspoken part of the transition is that it's actually a values discussion, and it's about redefining your own value system, or at least examining it, right? Because the values in the service, you know, they're very explicit, and they're kind of provided for us, and you kind of take that as a common assumption. Anytime you're kind of dealing with someone, you kind of assume they have the same set of values, and it's a good assumption. It's kind of why the whole thing works. But figuring out what's important to you isn't something that you want to do by inertia. You know, you definitely want to be intentional about, you know, having these kind of existential conversations with other people and being being reflective. And as a part of that, a lot of the common advice that you hear is going to be, you know, is to kind of like narrow the universe of opportunities, by selecting kind of some different attribute, you know, like geography or company size or compensation or like whatever it is. Like, that's sort of like the common advice. But what you should remember when you're doing that is, like these attributes, they're reflective of certain values, and it's important to understand what the underlying values are that you're actually filtering on. Paul Graham has this good essay about different cities and what like different cities have to offer and what kinds of people tend to migrate there. And that's kind of a good way to think about the geography, the geography attribute when you're kind of filtering for that. Company size can be a proxy for, what kind of authority structure you want to work in or how much kind of back office support you want to have. Smaller companies tend to have a more fluid, tend to have more fluid authority structures and be kind of more ambiguous in the job description. And like I said, probably the most underrated value, in my opinion, is kind of the growth expectation, like the growth expectation of an organization. That just defines the mentality so much. If a company believes that their revenue is going to be much bigger next year, they're going to behave in a very different set of ways. And then I would say like the second big mistake that vets kind of make that is worth kind of highlighting is that they overly constrain themselves to the universe of what's possible. There's this story in this book. There's a book called The Once and Future King, and there's a story about King Arthur. He gets transformed into Merlin turns him into an ant, and in ant world there's this expression that like everything that's not forbidden is compulsory, and everything that's not compulsory is forbidden. And that's and in some sort of way, that's sort of what military life is like. And it's sort of, and it affects kind of how people think about their options. Most people are going to tell you that you want to reduce your options quickly, otherwise, you're just going to be scattered and have too much going on and not being able to kind of hone in on what you want to do. But make sure, make sure you're reducing your options for good reasons. To give you any kind of an example, I'm not sure if you remember this guy growing up, but there was a guy named Bob Ross.
The painter guy.
And so this dude, he would draw these beautiful scenery. He had this crazy perm, and he'd talk about like there's no such thing as mistakes. They're just kind of like happy little accidents. And like, believe it or not, this dude, he was like a 20-year vet in the Air Force. Like Bob Ross,
guy
with the crazy, the happy little trees and the happy little squirrels and the trees. He was an Air Force senior enlisted guy that was like yelled at people, and if you don't know who he is and you're listening, you should go on Netflix right now or YouTube and just like look for this guy. It's watch an episode because it's good for your soul. You kind of think of all the joy and creativity he brought into this world. And what a shame it would have been if Bob Ross had listened to all this like canned advice, and was like, and how he should take advantage of his operational expertise or whatever, and went and ran a factory. The dude loved painting, and he taught us a lot about how to live life, I think. So those are a lot of examples like that of folks that you probably never would have thought were vets. I think the guy that founded Paul Mitchell, which makes like shampoo for, makes like really high-end shampoo. Like he was a vet as well. So there's a lot of examples like this. And so don't constrain yourself. If you want to go do something, find a way to do it. I guess that would be kind of my long-winded advice for vets.
Oh man, I think that's so motivational. And I love that thought of looking at the growth of the company you join. And I love that thought of not constraining the possibilities. I think it is easy to paint ourselves into thinking there's only finite possibilities, but there's so many options, and some of them may take more work, but if you're following your passion, you can really take your career off-roading and achieve a lot of things that people wouldn't even consider part of their option set. So Brett, I know we're short on time now. Any final words before we close up?
I don't know. I would just say don't confuse signaling with substance at the end of the day when you're going through the process. They're both very important, but don't deceive yourself into thinking that some credential actually means that you're competent. Signaling is super useful and because it helps recruiters and it helps employers understand your quality more quickly. But that's a moot point if you show up and you actually suck at your job because you don't actually want to do it, or it doesn't fit your risk profile, or you kind of don't know who you are. So people kind of talk about going to grad school as an example. Going to grad school is, probably more signaling than substance. I mean, I haven't gone to grad school, so I probably shouldn't say that. But it's fine. But make sure you're honest with yourself about what the substance is. What is it that you really want to do? Because once you kind of answer those questions, you know, the signaling will be obvious at that point. You know, you'll understand if you need to go get a credential to do the thing you need to do, or if you don't. You know, so that would be kind of one of the things I think that's, you know, sometimes conflate. Like, oh, well, I'm in business now, so maybe I should go to the school that teaches you how to do business. Maybe that's not the best move. And maybe it is. You know, it just depends on what you want to do.
Awesome, Britt. Well, I found this extremely energizing. I know our listeners well as well. So thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
Surface.
Thanks for listening. Before you go, three important announcements. First, if you believe in what I'm doing and believe in supporting veterans in their careers, please, please, please help me spread the word. The best way I know to do that right now is by taking 18 seconds to write a review on iTunes. It would mean a lot. Second, based on my interviews, I'd advise any and all veterans to look at servicetoschool.org and the American Corporate Partners. Both are completely free for veterans and give you a lot of great resources for your education or professional life, respectively. Third, there are a ton of other great interviews, resources, and data at beyondtheuniform.io. Check it out, share it with your friends, and drop me a line if you have any feedback, because I'd love to hear from you. Thanks, and see you on the next interview.